Good day out there in podcast land. I'm your host, Peter Michaels. You're listening to Volume 1, Issue 1 of Talk Sports, where my sidekick, friend, and sometime opponent, Roscoe. Hello, Roscoe. How are you today?
I feel brilliant.
I'm sparkling today.
I'm sparkling. I'm wearing a new cashmere sweater that I'm very excited about. I bought it at Marshall Fields, which is now known as Macy's. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
They're practically giving cashmere away.
They're giving it away. This was a $200 sweater.
They must be growing in the bag.
Yeah, she said pay 50 cents for the bag and I'll just throw in the sweater.
Well, we're here with Talk Sports. And we're going to explore the lost sport of lively, provocative, and hopefully, Roscoe, amusing conversation. You know, with its jabs and left hooks, there's home runs, sometimes there's sacrifices, extra points, golds, strikes, and certainly there are sudden deaths. Talk can be a great sporting event, and we hope you'll enjoy listening as we prepare to square off and spar. We'll be talking about recent, sometimes esoteric topics, often employing the viewpoints and wisdom of some friends and colleagues, like phoning our longtime guru of gargantuan facts, Roscoe.
George from Midlothian.
George from Midlothian.
Unless he's at his summer home in Whiting, Indiana.
Anyway, we might be matching with some wits with artist friends. People here in our native Chicago. Yep, we're coming to you from beautiful Chicago, Illinois. There'll be plenty of Chi-Town high drinks for sure with a segment we call Roscoe is Large, sort of a man on the street piece where we send Roscoe to some of the more exotic places.
Thank you. We're on a podcast where people can't see me, but you must point out that Roscoe is large just so that they don't miss that.
I was
very
hoping
appealing description of me.
I was hoping that our rather intellectual audience would have inferred that amusing kind of play on words. But thank you for pointing it out
so
bluntly. We'll have a lot more of that, I'm sure. Anyway, we're going to probably send Roscoe to some places in this great metropolis to hear what's going on and
I have some exciting cultural updates.
I'm sure
we'll get
do.
To shortly.
We sure will, and we'll discuss the state and health of maybe Chicago theater, music, mm-hmm. The art world on a regular basis vis-a-vis the rest of the nation and the world. And there'll be a few surprise guests along the way, and who knows, we might actually get around to talking about some sports.
That would be thrilling.
You know, pitchers and catchers reported this week to spring training.
They did in Arizona.
Yeah.
Are all of them in Arizona? Florida.
No, some of them are in Florida. Mm. But I think that by today, all of them will have reported. So they're out there. They're throwing balls and strikes. They're, you know, doing the pick play and the leadoffs.
And Wrigley Field is in shambles.
It is in shambles. You don't have any season tickets to the Cubs anymore, do you?
I do not have season tickets to the Cubs currently. In fact, I haven't been to a Cubs game since 1988, and I didn't really understand what was happening. So I may not be the best person to be a co-host with you of Sports Talk.
I need to take you to a Cub game this year.
You do.
We need to do
you
that,
do.
And then we need to do a download on that. Anyway, grab yourselves a cocktail, no matter what time it is you're listening to us, and enjoy. And the score is now 0-0. And it's the top of the first. Are you ready to play, Roscoe?
I am ready to play.
So I want to start off right away with something really, really topical and close to each of our hearts, and you'll be able to speak very clearly on this. How about those Iceman Cometh reviews in New York City?
Oh, my God. They were unbelievable. Although I must say, and we need to give this context, the Iceman Cometh started at the Goodman Theater 3 years ago. A dream cast, Ryan Dennehy, Nathan Lane, and our dear friend Larry Newman Jr., who we went to college with.
Best man at one of my weddings.
Best man at one of your three weddings. I should point that out. But Larry Newman Jr. has been a working Chicago actor ever since we got out of college 10 years ago. They don't know how old we are. They can't see us. And he has never worked in a main stage show at the Goodman. So finally, and let's be kind.
Except for Christmas Carol.
Except for Christmas Carol, but that came after The Iceman Cometh, I believe. And as the years have rolled by, how do we describe our good friend Larry?
Well, he's gone from sort of semi-leading man to one of the really solid character actors in Chicago. I mean, he can play anything between a homeless psychopath to Hugh Hefner.
Well, this is unkind, but he only plays homeless psychopaths. That is his stock in trade.
I was trying to be kind with the broadness of his range. He could certainly do that.
So, yes, and it opened in Chicago, 5 hours long. And tickets were $150 3 years ago for the Goodman Theater.
That's only $30 an hour.
Well, that's true. So being a good friend to Larry Newman Jr., I purchased a ticket, and I spent 5 delightful hours in the theater, and it was a stunning production. But the New York Times had some quibbles about Nathan Lane's performance, and Nathan Lane, this is what I heard from inside sources, not to be revealed, were so upset about the review, he said, I'm not taking this to New York. Because he thought, I'll open on Broadway, the New York Times will say mean things about me, and I can't deal with that.
I think that was probably a wise decision on his part. He doesn't need to have that kind of scrutiny at this point in his brilliant career. However, it's now been moved to New York, and they opened it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Which is not the same as Broadway.
Not
it's
quite.
A little less risky.
But they still get the top-line reviewers. They got Christopher Isherwood back, and he did essentially the same kind of review, although he picked out a few of the New York cast members that they brought in to play some of the supporting roles, and he picked them out for special mention. Unfortunately, Larry Newman Jr. was not mentioned in those reviews. I wish he had been, because I'd love to have heard what they think of it. And I bet he wishes he had been, too.
I bet he wishes he had been, too. But I must say, I thought it was mean-spirited of the New York Times to yet again say Nathan Lane is great. Revelatory performance. Is that how you pronounce that word?
Revelatory.
I'm sorry, it's early and I've not had all my coffee. And brilliant. What stunning casting. What a wonderful idea. And to say he's magnificent, thrilling, still doesn't go deep enough in the role. You know, did we really need that unkind caveat, knowing that Nathan Lane is thin-skinned and that would upset him?
Do you think Jason Robards dug deeper?
I think Jason Robards dug for a bottle in his dressing room because he didn't care about the friggin' reviews.
Which may be what it takes to play that role of Hickey successfully. Now, I have a piece of inside news about this. There is a New York producer who's interested in taking the show as is and putting it in a Broadway theater. That's a kind of a difficult thing because those theaters don't often become available. And as you say, this is a 5-hour show. However, economically, financially, it only really works if you do 7 shows a week as opposed to the usual 8. And I think right now they're only doing 5. It'd be great to see a second life for this, or a third life even.
Or a third life.
Our friend Larry Newman Jr.
But you'd have to sell it every performance and charge astronomical prices, as you know from your history on Broadway.
Astronomical. I mean, you'd have to probably charge $250, $300, especially for a cast.
Yeah, you know, in 1999, Kevin Spacey did a revival, and it was... The structure of the financing was they had to sell it every performance. It was the first show where they charged $99 for a ticket, which was considered outrageous at the time, and everyone worked for scale. And they broke even, and it was well received.
Crazy.
But God, is that a long show, and they just talk about the same. It's brilliant. You know, Eugene O'Neill is one of our few playwrights to win the Nobel Prize, maybe the only American playwright to win the Nobel Prize. Perhaps I made that up.
I think you made that up.
Well,
and I'm going to have to go
research
that.
We might revisit that in the editing room later.
You might have to.
But you know, think about it. If Iceman Comes were written today, it's a bunch of old drunks sitting in a bar talking for 5 hours a night. It's not about me. And if it was written today, people, I don't think reviewers would say this is brilliant, this is profound. They would say this is self-indulgent, talky, and I was ready to tear my hair out if they talked about pipe dreams one more time.
Pipe dreams. Yeah, this is mentioned just about every fifth or sixth page in that play by every character there is. What have you seen lately, Roscoe? I mean,
I've seen a couple of things. There's I've been to the Lyric Opera. And to Porchlight Theater.
They let you in there.
To which?
The Lyric.
They did. I arrived late so people could not see the shabbiness of my wardrobe because people dress up for the opera. And it was an interesting experience. The Lyric Opera, once upon a time, was the hottest ticket in Chicago. They sold out every performance. You couldn't get near it. Ooh la la. Now you go on Gold Star and they say, oh, for the love of God, please come to Porgy and Bess. We'll just let you in for free. Or $15.
Just come dressed like Porgy and you'll get
come
in for free.
Come dressed like Porgy. Bess, I is your woman now. Was the what I had on my t-shirt for that show. So I got an industry comp for Tannhauser. Someone sent it to me. Wagner's Tannhauser. Or is it Tannhauser?
Tannhauser.
Tannhauser. I was never good with accents, which was why my theater career was thwarted. And we can talk about that in a
later broadcast.
Talk
about five-hour productions. So how long was this, and did you make it through?
It was 4 hours and 40 minutes, and I got a ticket for $29. It was an industry ticket, and I couldn't get it online. I tried it one day. The next day, it didn't work. So I called the Lyric Opera, and I said, and this man answers the phone and goes, hello, Lyric Opera. And I go, hello, this is Roscoe Fraser. I'm trying to get an industry discount for Tannhauser, and I just can't seem to get the website to work. Have those tickets been pulled? No, I can help you. So he was quite charming, and I got a box seat, rear box. It's a $200 seat.
A rear box,
but it was a $200 seat. There were only 7 chairs in my 8-chair box, and 2 of those chairs were occupied by 2 very unpleasant people. And some young girls showed up, apparently, on their way to Los Angeles via Chicago from Prague, and they spoke no English, but they were interested in going to the opera. I could not understand. I mean, maybe size women who wear size 2 could all fit comfortably in the box. Roscoe at large could not fit comfortably in the box, and a chair was missing. So a very nice usher tried to help me. The woman of a certain age continued to be unpleasant, and I just couldn't get in my seat. I couldn't, and it was not the width. It was like flying economy on Southwest Airlines.
Well, it's again one of those encroachment issues. You can't go to the Lyric Opera.
You can't go to the Lyric Opera without being encroached on.
Mm-hmm.
Without being squeezed next to strangers.
You have to sit in the Pope's box in order to have a little elbow room.
Well, that is in fact what happened.
Really? You got transferred to another box?
I came out of the theater and I said to the usher, I said, I know the answer is no. You have to sit where your ticket is. I cannot fit in my seat. And she goes, let me try to help you. So we go in. The overture has started.
Did she try to stuff you into the seat?
Well, she brought in the 8th chair that was missing.
See, I see.
And the pleasant woman said, how is he going to sit in that? How is he going to fit there? So I tried. It was like sticking a marshmallow down the top of a Coca-Cola bottle. I didn't think I was going to be able to pull myself out with those armrests snugly encasing me in my chair.
Yeah, you'd have to crush the chair under you in order to get you extricated each time you sat down.
I might have been fined. So I walked out. I walked out of the box, and I sat in the lobby, and the overture was playing, and the usher said, what are you doing? And I said, I can't fit in there, and that woman is being unpleasant. And I'd left out a step with a woman who'd come out to scream at the usher, as if the usher were the general manager of the Lyric Opera and were responsible for the seating.
Mr. Wagner, this man is he's taking up the whole box.
He's taking up the whole box. How am I to enjoy this? And she made a point of saying, I paid $200 for my tickets, and these ladies from Poland paid $10.
I thought they were from Prague.
So I was ready to go home at that point because I wasn't going to be miserable for
$29. For $29,
you know, yeah. So I said the woman is being unpleasant to me, and she said, aren't you with that woman? I said, no, I'm by myself. She's a total stranger, and she said, oh. Then she got on her house phone, called the house manager, and said, I have a very nice gentleman here who's in a difficult situation. There is some unpleasantness in his box. And she goes, hangs up, puts up a finger, walks away from me, walks over to another box, enters, comes back, looks at me, and she goes, the Lord do work in mysterious ways. And I said, don't he, though? And then I was escorted into a box by myself. No one else was sitting there.
No.
And in the box next to me, only one person was sitting there. The overture continues. A bunch of dancers rush on stage. I realize in my $200 seat, I'm about a thousand miles from the stage. I was looking at miniature people on stage. I might as well have been across the street. And even though I had read the program notes 3 times, I had absolutely no idea what was happening on stage.
Did you manage through the full 4 hours and 40 minutes?
I left at nine.
Be truthful now.
I left at 9. I made it through 3 hours. So the first act was a little over an hour. They have the longest intermissions in the history of the planet. And I also should say, in the first act, other than the dancing, there were about 3 people on stage. It was not a lot to look at. The second act, it took 15 minutes to get 500 people on stage to sing a plaintive chorus about something, and I had no idea what was happening. And I, you know, I'm not a stupid guy.
You see a lot of things. That's true.
I see a lot of things.
As we both do, we're fairly well versed in the performing arts, and see a lot of it.
Tragically, not in opera, in my case.
Well, it's about the spectacle for me. I'm not really a big opera fan in terms of watching an opera. However, every time I go, I just absolutely mesmerized by the giant spectacle, especially on a level of something like the Lyric or the Met. But I admit, I'm not an aficionado of the music of opera. But I'm so glad that you made it through at least the three quarters. What could have been totally inscrutable for you.
Yeah, get this. It began at 6. I left at 9. And according to the program, the performance was to continue until 10:40.
Wow. Look, speaking of spectacle, tomorrow,
the Academy Awards.
What do you think? Who's your pick? Who's your dark horse? Who's your favorite?
Oh.
I know, there's
a lot
of
questions. Everything is a foregone conclusion, except, I think, for Best Actor. And Michael Keaton has been the favorite all along. And suddenly Eddie Redmayne, with the freckles on his lips, looks like he's going to snatch the award.
You know what? There aren't really any movie stars anymore. I mean, I'll grant you Meryl Streep. And boy, what are the odds of her actually winning over Roseanne Arquette? That would be quite something. How many Oscars would that be for her?
That would be 4. 2 Best Actress and 2 Supporting.
Not quite a record.
No, that will never happen.
Not tomorrow, no.
No.
But, you know, there's no movie stars anymore. In the studio system, you know, they created movie idols for us. They created the image. They created this backstory. They created the Cary Grants and the Burt Lancasters and the Barbara Stanwyck. Where are those great movie stars? I'm not saying that they're not great movie actors and great performers these days. I just miss movie stars, like Joan Crawford. Now,
Joan Crawford.
I mean, you could probably go on and on about Joan Crawford.
I could. You know what was interesting about Joan Crawford is she was the first movie star to not have any kind of acting background. She'd never acted in stage.
Where was she discovered?
She was a dancer. She was known for having round heels. She wasn't a woman of easy virtue. And this is what I've heard. And so she...
And read.
Well, maybe I talked to some people who knew Joan Crawford. So maybe I heard it as well.
Ooh. Well, I'd touch you, but I'd afraid I'd burst into flames.
You might. But Joan Crawford was, you know, created by the studio. She, it's the line that Peter O'Toole has. I'm not an actor, I'm a movie star.
I'm a movie star.
Where she understood everything about what it meant to be a star without really ever being a great actress. The concept of subtext was foreign to her. She thought that lines meant what they said.
Yeah, I find watching her movies almost intolerable.
That's because you're a heterosexual. But let's go back to the current Academy Awards. Talking about Joan Crawford's making me nervous.
All right.
I think, and they never do it right. Recently I saw a clip from the Tony Awards, Donna McKechnie winning for A Chorus Line. This is 1975. This is what happened. The camera's on Donna McKechnie. They announce that she wins, and the camera follows her look, her reaction, her surprise, as she walks to the stage in triumph with tears starting, one single shot, gives her acceptance speech. It's lovely. It's thrilling. Now they announce Jennifer Hudson for Dreamgirls. They cut away from Jennifer Hudson. You don't see her hug Beyonce. They show a clip from the movie. They show 97 graphics. This is her first Academy Award. She has never been nominated before. This is her first motion picture.
And make sure you get a cutaway shot of Felicia Rashad.
Get a cutaway shot of Felicia Rashad in the audience saying, why wasn't that me?
Even though she wasn't nominated.
Even though she wasn't nominated and is only a nominal singer. Actually, getting back to Into the Woods, I saw Felicia Rashad in the original Broadway production of Into the Woods after Bernadette Peters had left.
I saw her in that production as well.
And we're thinking what?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was a bit of a copycat performance. I didn't see any, you know, I don't think she explored any depths that Bernadette Peters had not explored, to be frank with you.
Are there depths to the witch?
Well, there are depths to every character, don't you think?
I think so. Joan Crawford didn't think so.
No,
to Joan Crawford.
You know, that style of performance, even if we don't even call it acting, there's nothing wrong with it. Spencer Tracy was of the same school. Show up on time, know your line, hit your mark, say it in your light, and then shut up and get off. He had no qualms about telling people that he had no acting style. Acting was not for the movies. He was a movie star, and that's what he did. I miss people like that.
Well, and I miss the fact that Oscars have stopped celebrating old Hollywood, and I see this with young people I work with. They've never seen a movie in black and white. If I mention Cary Grant, they don't know who Cary Grant is. Katharine Hepburn, they would say, "Well, I've heard of her," but for some reason in contemporary culture today, with anyone under 30, old Hollywood is of no possible interest to them.
Well, is that a bad thing necessarily, or not?
It means that they're missing out on a lot of classic films and that they're somewhat illiterate. Illiterate in terms of the culture of America.
Tell us what you think.
America was defined, you know, the vision of America, you know, movies represent our vision, our interpretation of America. So you can watch a movie from the 1930s and say, it's somewhat of a stretch, but these were the manners and morals of this time. This is how people comported themselves. This is how they spoke, how they dressed, how they walked, how they treated one another. And then to not see that is just to be ignorant of the past.
Well, you and I are of the same kind of school of, to really appreciate something, one needs to really understand where it came from the beginning. And there's a lot of things like that. Cooking is like that. Wine making is like that. The theater is like that. Opera is like that. I mean, you can certainly walk into a piece of music that you have no idea about, that you've never heard. Even if we took somebody who just like plopped out on the planet for the first time and stuck him into Mozart's Requiem, first and foremost, they would think, what an unbelievably beautiful piece of music. If you really want to appreciate that fully, you have to go back to the backstory and learn about his life and where his musical abilities and his musical sensibilities came from early music back in the 15th, 16th century. I think that just expands people's understanding and appreciation of what you have today. Now, can you like a movie like The Theory of Everything? Sure, but if you look back on performances like Eddie Redmayne's, you'll understand where his style of acting and his appreciation for character development comes from. I just think they're missing out a lot.
Did you see The Theory of Everything?
No.
I've heard it compared unfavorably to My Left Foot, for which Daniel Day-Lewis won the Academy Award, as you know, in 1987.
When you say it compared unfavorably, you mean as a movie? Not as good?
Well, that his performance wasn't quite as thrilling.
Well, how could it be? I mean,
it's Daniel Day-Lewis.
That was a singular performance, you have to admit.
I had a friend who was an actor, and he had cancer as a child, and he had his left foot amputated. And he later did a one-man show about his battle with childhood cancer called My Foot Left, which I thought was pretty brilliant.
That is pretty brilliant.
But can I make another comment about the Oscars? And I feel like I need to talk to you about what you just said about Mozart, and I just don't have it. I learned from you.
That's kind of what we're here for. It's a back and forth. We're just talking. It's talk sports.
It's talk sports.
Talk sports.
Talk sports.
Talk sports.
Talk sports. Yeah. Are we going to talk about sports?
We could talk about sports. Let's talk about Brian Williams for a minute.
Brian Williams. Now, his game is over. How's that?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. You're peripherally associated with the journalism world and have been for many, many, many years. What do you think? Is he getting a raw deal? Is it hubris on his part? And do you think it's really over for him?
I think it's over for him. I think the evidence to date is that he's getting a raw deal. You know, I saw some footage of him saying, you know, I was in a helicopter with some guys, and, you know, they anonymously mailed me a piece of this helicopter.
Yeah, I think he just inflated his own presence in historical events. Like, oh, yes, you know, on one hand, yes, he might have been in the Revolutionary Army. On the second talk show, he was in the boat with Washington crossing the Delaware, right. And he's in that picture.
Yes.
I mean, it's panning out a bit like one of my favorite movies, Broadcast News. And don't get me started on Holly Hunter.
That was a brilliant performance. Brilliant performance. And did she lose the Oscar to Cher?
For Moonstruck?
Moonstruck. Can
I
that be possible?
So. Yeah.
Can you believe Cher has an Oscar?
Yeah. And a couple of nominations.
And that untalented former wife of Alec Baldwin. What was her name?
Kim Basinger.
She has an Academy Award.
She does.
She stole it away from that.
L.A. Confidential.
Yeah. And what a career she's had.
Well... She had a good career going for a while. She was a certain type for a certain time. Anyway, back to Broadcast News. You remember this movie, and you remember, you know, what her whole problem with the anchor guy that she's fallen in love with and has a big crush on, and that he does this piece about rape, and it's about being raped by someone you know, like... your boyfriend or your husband, and he does this piece before he's actually the big anchor, and it turns out that he'd done a cutaway shot, because they only had one camera, he did a cutaway shot of himself crying over what this woman was telling him as the story, but she goes back and she finds the actual raw footage and finds that he fabricated the whole thing, that...
This is William Hurt.
Yeah, William Hurt. Then when one of the crew people says, wow, you really look like you were about to just lose it when she was telling you that, he said, really? Well, you know what? Give me a minute. And he makes himself cry as a reaction shot. And, of course, Holly Hunter, who's nothing but straight and narrow and absolutely strict about the morals of journalism and the ethics, goes berserk about the whole thing. Of course, it really is just her way of breaking up that relationship because she can't get in relationships and she's always looking for ways to sabotage them like she does with Albert Brooks. It's a brilliant movie. It's one of the great underrated movies now, I think. People don't even know this movie.
They don't
movie
know it.
Anymore.
They don't see it. It's not around.
You know, it should have a revival.
Holly Hunter's not around.
It should have a revival
It
right
should have
now.
A revival.
You know, the Brian Williams story.
We'll do a screening at the Music Box.
We could do a screening at the Music Box. I think people would show up for that. It's a lovely movie. It's a beautiful script. It's so well made. Joan Cusack's in that film. As you say, William Hurt. They're all fantastic at it, especially her. But let's get back to...
The Oscars?
The Oscars. They're on tomorrow night. You plan to watch?
I plan to watch while vacuuming and cleaning my house because it's a long, tough slog. Can I talk about another missed opportunity with
course,
the Oscars?
Of course.
We're talking about how they don't, they, you know, there is no old Hollywood. Olivia de Havilland is still alive. Maybe she's cogent. I don't know. She was on a few years ago. She's probably the oldest Academy Award winner still alive. But she won a performance Oscar in 1946, of course, for To Each His Own, and then again in 1949 for The Heiress. Very bitter that she lost to her sister Joan Fontaine in 1941 when she made the Snake Pit. and Joan Fontaine won for Suspicion.
Suspicion.
When she really should have won the previous year for Rebecca, but that, of course, went to Ginger Rogers for Kitty Foyle, because everyone loved Ginger Rogers.
Yeah, that was one of the great faux pas of Oscar winning history.
A terrible mistake. But you know, something that I, one year they had Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers came out to present, just you know, 30 years ago, and they had been, you know, Ginger Rogers hadn't made a movie in 40 years. Well, they danced together briefly on the Oscars, and it was a lovely moment. And I was thinking, you know, a few years ago was the 50th anniversary of West Side Story winning. And every actor who won that year, Maximilian Schell, Sophia Loren, Rita Moreno, George Chakiris, were all still alive. Why didn't they bring them out and
why
say,
not have
50
them come
years
out?
Ago, the West Side Story and the following people all received Academy Awards, but no, they're not John Travolta. They're not that trashy Miley Cyrus. They're not some unknown asterisk in movie history.
They could have had them come out and give the award for the performances that they had won for.
Or for anything.
Yeah. Speaking of the lyric, going back to that, they're doing Carousel this year as part of their ongoing let's do a Broadway show every year and see if we can sell a bunch of tickets to that kind of thing.
And try to make some money.
We mentioned Porgy and Bess.
Porgy and Bess. And last year they did... 2 years ago they did Oklahoma?
2 years ago.
And then they did The Sound of Music. And as a friend of mine said, you've never seen so many nuns on stage in your life because they've got a big budget.
The men were dressed as nuns.
Even the men were dressed as nuns. And apparently the set was thrilling, and it was the thrilling production. But this is the issue. Musical theater is not meant for gigantic auditoriums. You lose everything when you can't see the actors.
Yeah, you mentioned it yourself. You can barely fit in the seats in a Broadway theater. And some of them are well under 1,000 seats. 900, mm-hmm. 850. You know, they're small, intimate palaces.
Yeah, when I saw Hairspray in New York, it was at the Neil Simon Theater. Small theater. I thought the theater was going to explode. The finale was so exciting. So much happening. You look right to left. The stage fills the whole width of the theater. It comes here. It plays at the Oriental Theater, which was 9 times as big, and the actors were tiny on stage. I hadn't been in the Oriental Theater since my father took me to see Helen Hayes and her Academy Award winning performance in Airport in 1970.
Whoa.
So I'm bridging back to the Academy Awards.
Yeah, you can probably, if you're sitting in the farthest reaches of the balcony at the Oriental, you're probably a good 300 to 350 feet from the stage. That's a long way.
Yeah, so what's the point?
Speaking of which, have you eaten at Glenn's Diner recently?
I did one better. Glenn's Diner, of course.
So totally non sequitur. But there's a reason I asked.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I eat at Glenn's Diner on Montrose about 4 times a week. And the previous owner of Glenn's Diner is opened a new restaurant called Falstrom's, which is his last name, on Belmont. It's almost completely identical, except, get this, a raw oyster bar. And their oysters are a very affordable $1.25.
Oh.
So I went there last Sunday, and I 6 oysters for, you know, $9. So I ordered a dozen. I decided I needed a few shrimp.
What's the name of the place?
Falstrom's.
We were going to get back to Carousel.
I'm not going to go.
What?
I'm not. If I could get a ticket for
$29,
I would go.
You will.
I went to Oklahoma a few years ago, and the... You know, it's about young Curly and young Shirley Jones. Laura. Is her name Laura?
Lori,
right. Well, the actors who played them were well into their 40s. It was like, you know, on Golden Oklahoma. And, you know, they could barely move. And, the music was lovely. But again, I'm looking at people that are 2 inches tall from where I'm sitting. And it wasn't thrilling.
This is why they made opera glasses, so you could see them life-size from the back row.
Opera glasses are a challenge when one wears bifocals.
Well, maybe you could get something that kind of suction cups onto your bifocals and like little telescope things.
That would be lovely.
Kind of like that cat or that character in Who Shot Roger Rabbit, where his eyes pop out. Well, yes. Ooga, you know, that kind of thing.
And people will say, look, in that box. See,
and then you could go back
that
in that box.
That must be Large Roscoe sitting
alone. This man, his eyes keep popping out and begging me in the back of the head. I paid $200 for this.
I'm not sitting with him.
I'm not going to sit with him. Someone get me the general manager. Someone get me Richard Wagner.
I saw Carousel. That was Audra McDonald's first big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
1993 revival.
Yeah, she didn't play Laurie.
No.
She played Laurie's best friend, who marries Mr. Snow.
Yes.
And her big song was Mr. Snow.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the woman who played Laurie had a... Give me a Laurie song.
If I Loved You.
And so the woman is very sweet, and it was, If I Loved You, time and again, da-da-da-da-da. And then Audra McDonald would come in and go, His name is Mr. Snow. And just like blow everyone else off the stage. It was unbelievable.
I'm sure she was brilliant in it. What an odd choice, though, because the voices don't really kind of match.
No.
Richard Rodgers probably would not have cast Audra McDonald.
No. Well, especially not in, you know, the 1940s.
Well, yes. Given all things being equal, I just don't, I think that, you know, vocally, she's got that operatic quality to her voice, which is fantastic. Now, you saw her in Lady Day just recently. Did you?
Well, not recently, but last
season.
I saw her twice because I thought it was the most amazing performance I'd ever seen in my life. I thought it was such a mistake because she has that distinctive, huge lyric soprano voice. But apparently she spent 2 years learning how to sing exactly like Billie Holiday. And both times when I saw the show, the audience gasped when she started. She got four notes into her first song, and you heard everyone go, oh! And the man next to me said, well, she sounds just like her. And I said, please don't talk. you're not at home watching television.
Right.
But I went twice, and towards the end of the show, I'm not giving anything away, Billie Holiday was a heroin addict. She shoots up, and then she comes back on stage, and she's not in really good shape, and she falls off the stage into the audience. And both times I screamed like a 12-year-old girl.
Did she fall in your lap?
No, I was not in the $250 seats.
Oh.
But it was pretty thrilling.
You've seen a lot of Broadway over the years, and I'm envious of you. As you know, I had a long association with Broadway. And
well, you're being
Broadway.
Humble. You've actually appeared on the Broadway stage.
I have appeared in a Broadway musical, and indeed for not just one performance. It was a rather lengthy stretch as we were depleted by illness and injury, and they finally went down the roster of which of our stage managers can sing and dance. Well, my hand shot up, and the rest is history. Hey, listen, we were talking about Louis Jordan. He was a handsome, sad-eyed French actor. Louis Jordan is...
I've been mispronouncing his name my entire life.
Louis Jordan.
You
know, if you're going to be... you know, absolutely religious about that. He was 93. People in their 90s, you know, are passing like crazy. Well, we have a little segment that we like to call the Kiss of Death. And as you know, Roscoe, I have a penchant for...
Well-written obituary.
The well-written obituary. Thank you for putting it that way. This one's not particularly well-written, I didn't think, by a gentleman in the New York Times who will remain nameless just because.
Out of kindness.
Out of kindness. But he passed away last Friday in Beverly Hills. I can't believe he still lived in Beverly Hills. How these old movie actors, you know, still live in Hollywood. They can't go anywhere. But Mr. Jordan, pronounced Louis Jordan, I like when they put in the actual pronunciation of their names as if you had never heard this person's name, was a reserved actor whose quiet manner lent his performance an aura of mystery and even of melancholy. His characteristic reticence served him well in both sympathetic and unsympathetic roles. You know, he played quite a few of those. He was born Louis-Henri Gendret in Marseille. Why couldn't that have been me? There, but for the grace of God, goes...
Well, change your biography. Could you read that phrase again?
Not a chance in a million years.
That was beautiful.
June 19th, 1921. What was happening in 1921? Well, it was between the wars.
It was
a between-the-war guy. But
the second season of Downton Abbey, I think, was...
Yeah, he attended acting school in Paris and was quickly tapped for a role in a film by director Marc Allegret. But the outbreak of World War II interrupted the production and the movie was never completed. But he appeared in several French films during the occupation. You know, there's something. I would have liked to have lived in France during the occupation. I know that seems crazy to say, but I would have joined the French underground and I would have been a saboteur and I would have blown stuff up.
I can see you crawling around in sewers.
You
would have liked that.
Many people can. Yeah.
You would have been very proud of yourself.
I would have. I would have, you know, hiding in, you know, basements and in garrets and, you know, backs of cafes from the Gestapo. Gestapo, I guess.
Gestapo.
Well, he appeared in several films during that occupation, but after his father, a hotelier, was arrested by the Gestapo, here it is, right here in black and white, Mr. Jourdan joined the Resistance, another activity for which his reserve must have proven useful, which means, you know, he would be able to just sort of wander kind of sad-eyed and reticently through crowds, and no one would have picked him out as a major spy or someone working in that. After the war, Mr. Jourdan came to the United States and attracted the attention of the producer David O. Selznick. Well, that's a pretty famous producer, who cast him in the courtroom drama The Paradine Case in 1947, very much against the wishes of the director,
Alfred Hitchcock.
Very good. His character, a slightly sinister valet suspected of murdering his employer, was originally conceived as a rough, earthy type, which Mr. Jourdan clearly was not. Mr. Hitchcock referred to him as, quote, a pretty, pretty boy.
Do you think he was more handsome than Robert Goulet?
I think Louis Jourdan had a look that really didn't change all that much over the years. He was always kind of the same handsomeness, even in the Gigi days or Octopussy. But
they really made a movie called Octopussy.
It's a James Bond film.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know that, and I'm still just stunned when I hear someone say it out loud.
Yeah, my favorite line is when he says, Octopussy, Octopussy.
What was Honor Blackman's character in the James Bond movies?
Honor Blackman.
She played Pussy Galore.
Pussy Galore, yes, certainly.
Also shocking.
In Goldfinger, I believe.
How did that get past the censors? Anyway, I'm sorry. Let's return to the tragedy of Louis
Jourdan. But I think that Robert Goulet had a very short period of time when he was possibly the most handsome man in show business. He was the George Clooney of his time.
But he didn't have the bone structure. Do you think it was bone structure?
You know, he was Canadian.
Yeah, the Canadians do not age well.
No, they don't age well.
Very cold.
Anyway, but Hitchcock complained about that casting, and it said it destroyed the whole point of the film. There appears to have been no lingering personal antagonism, however. Mr. Jourdan was among the mourners at Mr. Hitchcock's funeral in 1980.
You know what they left out in that obituary? And I don't know the story here. He was originally cast in On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, the original Broadway production with the crazy Barbara Harris. And he left the show 8 days before opening, and John Cullum had 8 days to learn the role and open in the show. That's all I know. Perhaps one of our listeners could call in and tell us the reason that Louis Jourdan left the production.
Well, I'm sure George from Midlothian, the guru of gargantuan facts, knows this off the top of his head. And he's probably just sitting there waiting for our show to be over so we can dial the show. We don't have the dial-in capability just yet, but we're going to pretty soon. And for the last 30 years of his performing life, Mr. Jourdan, still attractive and still impeccably dignified, but looking a bit more world-weary with every passing year, was cast more often as the Prince of Darkness than as Prince Charming. Mr. Jourdan was, by all accounts, well-liked in Hollywood, but he kept his private life very private. In 1946, he married Bertha Frederick. Bertha Frederick. That's a kind of a stripper name in a way. They remained married until her death last year.
Do the math. I tried to figure that out. More than 50 years? 60.
More than year. More than. 46, so that's 54, 64, 68 years, almost 69 years.
That sort of makes me cry.
How many people do you know that celebrate their 75th wedding anniversary? They were
within shooting distance.
The couple had one child, Louis Henri Jourdan Jr. I don't know how to say junior in French, but that was it. Who died of a drug overdose in 1981. at the age of 29. Don't they all?
They all. That's Beverly Hills.
A brother, Pierre Jordan, that's a nice name too, was an actor and a theater director in France. He died in 2007. Louis Jordan made his last appearance on screen in 1992 in the caper film Year of the Comet. He, of course, played the bad guy.
Wow.
So not particularly well written, but what a fascinating life this guy had.
Yeah, and you know what would be interesting? This just occurred to me, and I didn't know that Louis Jordan, did I say that right?
Jordan
had been in the French Resistance because he co-starred in Gigi with Maurice Chevalier, who was known to coddle up to the Nazis and say, oh, you're going to take over Paris, great, I'll entertain.
Make heaven
for little girls. You know, I'll entertain at your parties. So there must have been some animosity. I mean, you know, Maurice Chevalier was not widely embraced. It was you know, got a lot of flack after the war, as well he should.
They didn't have a lot of scenes together in that movie, though.
I can't stand that movie.
Really?
I find it insulting. It's basically about a woman who's forced into prostitution.
Yeah, she's 14 or something.
She's 14. It's distasteful and upsetting and dated and grotesque.
I came across another Kiss of Death feature earlier today. This is someone that very obscure. A gentleman named Raul Rodriguez died recently at the age of 71. Raul Rodriguez, who designed more than 500 floral floats for the Tournament of Roses parade and conceived dazzling confections for other private and public celebrations around the world, he died on Wednesday in Pasadena. Well, if you're going to go, you might as well go where the Tournament of Roses is. His spouse, Robert Cash, said that Mr. Rodriguez had been ill for some time and he died of cardiac arrest. I started reading this going, well, this doesn't seem very interesting. And then I got about four or five paragraphs in. His most conspicuous creations were those he made for the Rose Parade. He designed his first when he was 15, a snow scene for the city of Whittier in California. You're familiar with the floats in the Tournament of Roses.
Oh, absolutely.
Who's not? And his final one in 2014, when typically he fielded multiple floats in the annual New Year's Day procession. Mr. Rodriguez was classically trained in drawing and painting, but when it came to pageantry, he might just as well have been inspired by Oscar Wilde's credo that nothing succeeds like excess. In 2013, the chromatic Dreaming of Paradise float he designed for Dole Packaged Foods, Dole the pineapple people, and which he rode on with his signature pet macaw, featured a 26-foot-tall volcano spewing smoke and flame and 1,000 gallons of recycled water cascading into a fruit-laden tropical rainforest adorned with about 25,000 hot pink roses, 10,000 dendrobium orchids, and 8,000 fluorescent orange roses.
That's fantastic. Is there a photograph of that there?
Well, there is. It's unfortunately in black and white,
oh, Lord.
So it doesn't do it justice. But there he is in the front of the float with his macaw.
His trademark pet macaw.
His trademark macaw. The city of Cerritos in California once asked him to replicate its library on a float to encourage reading. Instead, he whimsically built a 50-foot-tall bookworm. I think I remember that float sort of bookworming around.
Wow, yes,
and
it was
sort of reticulated and it would, you know, turn corners and stuff. For natural balance pet foods, he conceived a 113-foot-long float on which dogs could slide down a chute into 4,000 gallons of water. Mr. Rodriguez viewed his floats as, quote, moving stage sets. And, you know, indeed they were. There was a lot of movement and activities happening on them. No wonder the guy was just absolutely a genius at this. Unique art forms that allowed him to recreate exotic locales from around the world while his fanciful creations were meticulously planned for months. They were built with natural components and typically for one-time events, which meant they usually lasted only a matter of days. It's kind of, you know, site-specific theater, isn't it? Like doing Death of a Salesman in a men's urinal.
Yes.
Type thing.
You can in only a men's really, bathroom.
Yeah. You can only do it.
Or you'd stage it in a urinal, but that would be interesting.
True. All right. Willie, drag yourself over to the urinal and plop down in despair. Enter Biff. In an interview with the Glendale News Press, he described the Rose Parade as the 5.5-mile smile.
Oh, that's good Lord. Nice. Do you watch the Rose Parade?
Yeah, I used to, but now I just can't get up early enough on Thanksgiving Day to do it.
15,
or New Year's Day to do it.
Yeah, 15 when he did his first float.
Can you believe it? Yeah,
do
15.
Do you think, let's try to imagine this scene in his family's home that day when he came home and said, "Guess what, Daddy? I just designed a parade float made out of flowers."
"Oh, Raul, I've told you to stop playing with those flowers. How many times do I have to ask you? Now get out there and play with that soccer ball."
"I don't want to."
Oh, nice. Good comeback, Raul. That was good.
"I'm afraid."
And then Mrs. Rodriguez, "Oh, let him do what he wants to do."
Something like that. Yeah. And then he would cry and hug his mother.
Indeed.
Perhaps I'm...
Speaking of crying and hugging, lastly, but certainly not leastly, and I know this is probably going to bring a tear to your eye, Roscoe, Leslie Gore passed away this week. She was only 68.
Lung cancer.
Yeah, apparently. And that's too bad. She was a teenager in the 1960s when she recorded hit songs about heartbreak and resilience that went on to become feminist touchstones. She passed away in Manhattan with songs like "It's My Party," "Judy's Turn to Cry," and the indelibly defiant 1964 single "You Don't Own Me." I was humming that to myself in my head all week, oddly, thinking, why do I have this female anthem going through my head while I'm riding the Purple Line? Well, it's because I read this Leslie Gore thing and couldn't get over it. All recorded before she was the age of 18. Before she was 18, she was a big recording star. Miss Gore made herself the voice of teenage girls aggrieved by fickle boyfriends, moving quickly from tearful self-pity to fierce self-assertion. She once said, "I don't care what age you are, whether you're 16 or 116, there's nothing more wonderful than standing on the stage and shaking your finger and saying, 'Don't tell me what to do.'" Miss Gore, she was born Leslie Sue Goldstein.
Ah.
In 1946 in Brooklyn, and she grew up in Tenafly, New Jersey. And she had just turned 16. She was a junior in high school when her vocal coach had her make some piano and voice recordings and sent them in as demos with a youthful brightness in her voice. And it reached the producer, Quincy Jones. You know, there's always...
It's always Quincy Jones.
It's always a backstory.
The history of American music.
Who was then at A&R, the A&R man at Mercury Records, and he became her producer and mentor. Miss Gore recorded "It's My Party" on March 30th, 1963.
That's coming up, the anniversary.
It's coming up, yeah, in another month. And when Mr. Jones discovered that Phil Spector and the Crystals were also recording the song, he rush-released it within a week. It reached number one and was followed onto the charts by "Judy's Turn to Cry." It's a sequel to "It's My Party," frankly, that gets the boyfriend back. And other tales of teen romance like "She's a Fool," "That's the Way the Boys Are," and "Maybe I Know," as well as "You Don't Own Me." She once said, "It would be very foolish of me to leave school to go into such an unpredictable field on a full-time basis." When she was asked why she just doesn't give it all up and, you know, become a big singing star. Probably a smart lady. Miss Gore's string of hits ended when girl group pop gave way to psychedelia. But she kept performing in movies and television and theater and stage clubs, and she appeared in the 1960s in the Batman television series. Do you remember what character she played?
I read this, and I know.
Anybody? Anybody? I mean, Pink Pussycat.
That's a theme for this show.
The Pink Pussycat, it was one of Catwoman's sidekicks.
Wow.
That's very, very obscure, if you were to ask. Who played the Pink Pussycat on the Batman series? Leslie Gore, rest her soul. She reconnected with Mr. Jones for the 1975 album Love Me By Name, also filled with her own songs and drawing on guest performances, including Herbie Hancock, but it, too, was largely ignored. Out Here on My Own, a song Miss Gore wrote with her brother Michael Gore for the soundtrack for the movie Fame, became a hit for Irene Cara in 1980. It was nominated for an Academy Award. So she was nominated for writing. She also performed in musical theater. It always comes back to Broadway. Everything.
Everything comes back
Everybody
to Broadway.
Everybody wants to come back to Broadway, you know?
But where? Did she do Broadway? I think somebody said she did Blood Brothers. Is that correct?
It included a stint in the Broadway production of Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Really?
Yeah.
Why didn't we go?
She worked in television, hosting episodes of In the Life, a PBS News magazine series about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Transgender people. Sorry. Did I say transgender?
Transgender.
In 2005, she came out publicly as gay. In recent years, Ms. Gore had been working on a memoir and a Broadway show based on her life.
Can I talk about Leslie Gore?
Just briefly? One ever lets you talk.
This is the tragedy of my life.
All right, we're gonna break precedent here. This is gonna be less talk sports for a few moments, and we're just gonna let Ross talk.
All right, thank you. I think there's a lot to think about with Leslie Gore. Can you imagine what it would be like to have the apex of your achievement and career and your life happen before you're 18 years old? And then, you know, it's all downhill from there. I saw her about 30 years ago at the Chicago Theater. When the Chicago Theater first reopened, they would have series of you'd buy a series, a package of five shows.
Sure.
And one of them was this terrible 50s review. 50s and 60s, starring someone that I'd never heard of. And Leslie Gore came out and sang her three hit songs. And people were excited to see her, but you just thought, my God, this, you know, 30, 40 years later, this is her bag of tricks. And this is, she can probably do a lot more, and this is all anyone wants to see. And she, you know, flies to Chicago, gets 15 minutes of stage time. People are thrilled to see her, and then she goes down to the dressing room and waits for her curtain call.
Well, this is the pattern with a lot of the child actors from the 20s and 30s as well. I mean, Shirley Temple was no real different. Her career was essentially over by the time she was, what, 12, 11?
No, a little older than that. Her last film, I believe, was The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer in 1948 with Cary Grant.
Grant.
You know, won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay, which was by Sidney Sheldon, who later went on to become a novelist and write things like The Other Side of Midnight.
And a television producer. Yeah, without question.
But I loved her. I wanted her to win the Oscar for her Music for Fame. She co-wrote that with her brother, right?
She did.
Yeah, out here on my own.
So that's our... of death for this week. we usually close our cast with that segment, and this is going to be no exception. As I always do, I'll ask Roscoe if he has any final last words or thoughts.
I do. I had an interesting thing happen yesterday. You know, I'm getting older, and we had an all-staff meeting, and I work with a lovely woman who now lives in Florida. And she walked up to me at an all-staff meeting, and she said, "Ross, you look great. You've lost a lot of weight. Are you dying?" And I thought, oh, my God, what a thing to ask someone. And I said, "Am I dying?" And she said, "No, are you dieting?" So it was a tragic misunderstanding. And
well, dieting for you would be a form of dying.
Oh, my gosh.
You wouldn't be able to go to Glenn's Diner.
I wouldn't be
Glenn's
able to.
Glenn's Diner, one of the finest restaurants in the city, yeah. Right there on Montrose.
They always have 17 different kinds of fresh
fish.
Yeah,
right
Barramundi,
near the...
mackerel.
Right by the Brown Line tracks. But
Glenn's Diner.
Mm-mm-mm. And that new place with that $1.25 oysters.
I see some free oysters in our future, Gary, if we play our cards right.
You know how I love the shellfish.
Yes, well...
Well, that's about all the time we have for our podcast this week. Roscoe, it's been great volleying back and forth with you.
Thank you. It's been thrilling. And I love talking about sports, which we did so thoroughly today.
All right.
And I'm glad that all of the sports fans tuned in to hear us talk about all the exciting things that are happening with the Chicago teams.
Well, lots of good sports stuff coming up. Opening day baseball, then we're going to have the championship series of hockey and basketball. It's all going to be very, very, very exciting in the coming weeks.
Well, we'll talk about that in the coming weeks.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Have a great evening.